back to blaming both sides today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump makes new comments on the racist violence in Charlottesville, and this time he says there's blame on both sides. That is sure to reignite the controversy over his response to what happened in Charlottesville. We'll hear what he said today. Meanwhile, there is other news, like North Korea saying it will hold off on firing any missiles towards Guam for now. Some credit Trump's fire and fury rhetoric. But can that work in the long run?
That's a very good question that we'll have to be watching as this goes forward as to whether there is method to what seems like the Trumpian madness.
Plus, what eclipses have taught us over the centuries, and a Muslim comedian speaks up for female empowerment in France. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Tuesday. Glad you could make it. President Trump made some unexpected news this afternoon. As you might recall, yesterday the president read a carefully worded statement from the White House condemning the right-wing violence over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia. Trump specifically called out the KKK, neo-Nazis, and white supremacists as hate groups that are, quote, repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. Those comments came 2 full days after the president refused to single out right-wing extremists and blame the Charlottesville violence in on many sides. Well, today Trump was once again off script and suddenly back to where he was on Saturday.
I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides. I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either. And if you reported it accurately, you would say.
That's the president speaking to reporters in New York following an event meant to highlight an infrastructure initiative. Trump seemed to suggest that the heated rhetoric of at least some of the radical right-wing protesters in Charlottesville was justified.
I've condemned neo-Nazis. I've condemned many different groups, but not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists by any stretch. Those people were also there because they wanted to protest the taking down of a statue, Robert E. Lee.
And Trump went on to suggest that removing a statue of the Confederate Army leader who led the fight to preserve slavery in the South was the beginning of a slippery slope.
This week it's Robert E. Lee. I noticed that Stonewall Jackson's coming down. I wonder, is it George Washington next week? And is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
If you want to see and hear Trump's full comments from Trump Tower today, head over to PRI.org. And of course, we'll continue to follow this story as it develops over the next few days. Now, here's a thought. Doesn't it seem like ages ago we were worried about imminent war with North Korea? Nope, that was just last week. The good news, if you can call it that, is that this week it looks like there will not be a catastrophic war in Northeast Asia. Who knows what next week will bring, but for now, North Korea has shelved its plan to carry out a missile test near the U.S. territory of Guam. The Trump administration had threatened war if it did that. So, is it cause and effect? Well, there are a lot of moving parts here involving U.N. sanctions, China turning up the heat a bit on its ally and Trump's decision to push China on its trade practices. Here to help us parse it all out as simply as we can is Jacob Schlesinger of the Wall Street Journal. How close were we to war, Jacob?
Well, I mean, first, the honest answer is we don't know. But I think most experts would say we weren't that close, you know, despite the menacing rhetoric, which we've heard many times from Pyongyang, and the menacing rhetoric, which was admittedly unusual from Washington. Not really any sign that anyone was actually heading there. North Korea in particular does this a lot when they're looking for concessions, and they regularly back down. Despite President Trump's rhetoric of fire and fury, you know, we weren't real moving any assets in the region. We weren't actually on a wartime footing. So the war was, by all evidence available, more rhetorical than real.
North Korea, just to clear this up, they've only shelved their plan, right? I mean, they could wheel it out again next week as the U.S. begins military exercises in South Korea. So how close do you think we remain to war?
Sure. I mean, look, I mean, we don't really know if there's actually a plan, quote unquote, to bomb Guam or whether this was just a threat. But you're absolutely right that, you know, North Korea is a very volatile place and can change on a dime. And I think in particular, next week's exercises are certainly the next moment to watch and pay attention and see what their rhetoric is at that moment.
What do we know about why North Korea blinked in this instance?
Right. So, again, it's a North Korea is a very cryptic place. And so a lot is based on speculation and informed knowledge based on how they've behaved before. But look, there are a number of things, as you alluded to when you opened up, there's a kind of chain of complicated events in this chess game that is Asian diplomacy going on. You know, one of the things that happened hours before they blinked was that China said that they would enforce the UN Security Council sanctions that they had supported a week earlier, which banned imports from North Korea on a range of important commodities that are an important source of currency for North Korea. I think the North Koreans may have been surprised at the extent to which China was willing to comply with those sanctions, both in terms of timing and scope. And that seems to have played a role. And then as part of the complicated chain of events, you might ask, well, why did China do what it did? You know, their announcement happened a few hours after the Trump administration had said that they would move forward with a formal announcement, which they did Monday afternoon in Washington, to launch an investigation into Chinese intellectual property practices. And, you know, the question is whether U.S. trade pressure is playing some role in steering China to be more cooperative on North Korea.
Right. So there's that. China goes along with the UN sanctions. Kim blinks and backs off this threat to bomb near Guam. Is this a foreign policy triumph for Donald Trump?
You know, that's a really good question, and it is hard to know. I mean, Donald Trump certainly took an unconventional approach with the incredibly incendiary rhetoric, literally and figuratively, that he used in the last few days. And it's possible that that played some role in steering North Korea from the brink. On the other hand, it also played some role in pushing the brink as well. I'm not sure that they would have made that Guam threat without his own comments. And so I think that's a very good question that we'll have to be watching as this goes forward as to whether there is method to what seems like the Trumpian madness.
Was there a more nuanced message behind the headlines that perhaps we didn't see?
Well, you know, that's actually also a really good point. And you have to look at the totality of the Trump administration, not just the president himself. And certainly we've been getting somewhat different messages from his aides, in particular, Secretary of Defense Mattis, Secretary of State Tillerson. They've both been sending signals that suggest that, you know, behind the harsh rhetoric of their boss, that negotiation is still very much on the table. And in some ways, sort of suggesting that the president's rhetoric is a suggestion of the extremes that could happen if North Korea isn't willing to budge on these areas, but also particularly Secretary of State Tillerson holding out the prospect that if North Korea is willing to budge, there may be other things in store for them.
Jacob Schlesinger of The Wall Street Journal in Washington, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We hear a lot from President Trump and others these days about how China is commandeering our jobs and technology. But there's at least one U.S.-made product that China is still hungry for, apples. Specifically, red delicious apples, that stalwart variety that'll stand up to abuse in the bottom of your book bag and last forever. It has fallen out of favor here in the U.S. because, well, it's kind of mealy and bland. But it's huge these days in China, and that's good news for apple growers in Washington State. Sort of. Here's The World's Jason Margolis with the latest dispatch from our 50 States project.
Wenatchee, Washington bills itself as the apple capital of the world. Central Washington is a perfect spot to grow them. Cold winters, sunny summers, and low humidity. Michael J. Scott has been planting apple trees in Wenatchee since the late 1960s.
The orchard we're standing in right now is Gala.
He used to grow Red Delicious. No longer.
And my son, after he graduated from school, went off and got educated about growing apples. And he came home one day and looked at my Red Delicious trees, which were standing right here where we're at. He said, "Dad, this is not going to work."
Son showed Dad the business bottom line.
So I had 120 trees per acre in my red orchard. I've got nearly 2,000 trees per acre in my Gala orchard.
Beyond being able to plant more trees, Smith believes he's now growing tastier apples.
So I've tasted a lot of apples in my time, and I was a slow learner, but I'm thinking there are several varieties that are season-long, more dependably a taste treat than Red Delicious. How's that? Judiciously spoken.
In China, it's a different tale. David Smith is a fruit importer based in Shanghai. He's originally from Washington State. He says apples from Washington are a special gift in China, but not for their taste.
Red in China for hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years, has been an extraordinarily important color. It symbolizes luck, it symbolizes wealth, it symbolizes happiness. It carries all of these cultural meanings along with it. And so red fruits do very, very well.
He says, try as they might, Chinese farmers can't grow red delicious apples like they do in Washington State. The Chinese ones just don't look quite right.
It might look more square or more round. It won't have that beautiful elongated shape that they like to see in a red delicious apple. It won't be as shiny. It may not be as even colored as the fruit that comes out of Washington State.
But Smith admits the Washington Red Delicious is slipping in popularity.
While Chinese consumers still love the red color, they are becoming more and more knowledgeable about the flavor of the fruits. Whereas 5, 6, 7 years ago, when I first started in the fruit business here, people were still buying 95% with their eyes. What did it look like? But in the past few years, we're starting to see people say, okay, does it look good and does it taste good?
They're working on these problems in Wenatchee. Horticulturalist Kate Evans with Washington State University takes me inside a massive refrigerator filled with apples. It's her job to taste all of them.
It's very much like wine tasting, yeah. I mean, if we can't possibly go through that number of apples and swallow every piece as we're going through, it would have fairly detrimental effects, I think, on our digestion. Yeah, take a bite, chew it around, taste it, score it for different characteristics, and then spit it out.
So the big question is, do you eat apples away from work, or are you sick of them?
I can't tell you how many times people ask me that question. You know,
she generally avoids them outside of the office during tasting season. The odds of an apple making it from the testing stage in the lab to the grocery stores are extremely long. But there is one apple Evans has been working on that she's super excited about.
Well, I have to talk about the new Cosmic Crisp. I mean, Cosmic Crisp is typically a red apple that is ultra crisp.
It'll be commercially available in the U.S. within 2 or 3 years. Washington growers are betting that it'll be a winner. They've planted 600,000 Cosmic Crisp trees this year, and Evans expects some 5 million more trees to go in the ground next season. Todd Fryhofer, president of the Washington Apple Commission, says the new apple will be beautiful. But the old workhorse, the Red Delicious, isn't going away. He says it's exported to more than 60 countries for good reason.
It holds up tremendously well in long transits. As an example, it takes 45 days to get to India. That's just in transport.
And while Fryhofer insists that China is but one export market for Washington growers, it's a big one, and therefore gets a little extra love. Fryhofer shows me a cardboard gift box sold in China around the Chinese New Year.
So you can see here's our logo on it. And in a lot of cases, the consumers can go in and choose the apples themselves, pack them into this box, take them home and give them as gifts to people that they love very much.
If Washington State's marketing efforts in China continue to pay off, how might that impact growing decisions in Wenatchee? Back at the orchard, I asked Michael J. Scott if he'd rip up his trees again and go back to Red Delicious if demand and prices climb in China.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I think we can do it better here than anybody else can. Yeah.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Wenatchee, Washington.
If you'd like to be part of our 50 states coverage, just go to PRI.org and tell us your story about how globalization is affecting your community, or just tweet us using the hashtag 50 states.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to what you're missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's been a rough few days in West Africa. On Sunday, it was a likely terrorist attack on a restaurant in Burkina Faso that killed 18 people. Yesterday, a downpour in Sierra Leone caused mudslides that may have killed more than 500 people. The worst-hit region is on the outskirts of the capital, Freetown. That's where we hear from my BBC colleague, Umaru Fofana.
Wailing in the mountain town of Regent, just outside Freetown. For residents of Mount Sugarloaf, they've known nothing but tears all day. The mountain caved in from the top, and the accompanying ferocity of the mudslide completely covered dozens of houses, some of them two-story buildings. Many of the residents were asleep, but this man, Maliki Kamara, had just left to look out for his daily bread, leaving behind his entire family.
My wife is dead. My children are all dead. Four of them. Five of my siblings, my uncle, my in-laws, they've all gone.
In her confused state and with bruises all over her body, Adama Kamara was looking for her husband. They both dashed to different directions as they heard the mud wreaking havoc. Their baby gone.
We were inside. We heard the mudslide approaching. We were trying to flee. I attempted to grab my baby, but the mud was too fast. She was covered, alive.
From 4 o'clock, we call for rescue. There is no rescue.
There was barely any rescue effort at the scene, as this local chief, Fatmata Tarawali, told me. We started calling for rescue since 4 a.m. None came. Our community has sunk, she lamented. I saw people pulling out corpses from the rubble. They dragged them because there were no stretchers. Vice President Victor Bokarifo arrived at the scene.
You know, the disaster is so serious that I'm myself broken down. We're trying to cordon the area, evacuate the people, find what measures we could do to at least appease the people.
Are we talking about hundreds that may be lying dead in that rubble?
It is likely, because these are poor areas and illegal constructions have been going around the area. And with the population explosion Freetown and other cities are going through, we envisage hundreds maybe down there.
Is it a rescue mission now or it's a recovery mission?
Both.
Is it your view that the intervention has been really apt? I was there when some corpses were brought up. They didn't even have stretchers. They used their bare hands to build the corpses out.
It's an emergency. The hands, there are stretchers, there are ambulances, but this is an emergency.
It all now seems like a recovery mission. It will be difficult to determine exactly the number of people buried under the rubble. Dozens of corpses are said to have been recovered in Lomley and Juba in the west of Freetown, where the heavy rains have inundated communities.
The BBC's Umaro Fofana there reporting from just outside Freetown in Sierra Leone. When I heard the news today about the catastrophe there, I went onto Facebook and I found a striking post from Patrice Joua. She's from Liberia, next door to Sierra Leone, and the two countries have deep connections in history through slavery, also through their brutal civil wars in the 1990s and early 2000s, and the shared ordeal of Ebola. We spoke with Patrice Joua several times during that crisis, and when I saw her post today saying prayers to the people affected by the Freetown mudslides, I wanted to call her up.
I am still in shock and disbelief because, you know, as we assessed our countries, Liberia and Sierra Leone, and we've gone through so much from the war, the Ebola outbreak, and now, you know, people have barely recovered from the Ebola outbreak, and seeing something like that happen, you know, while people are trying to rebuild their lives, it's just, I just can't process it. It's heartbreaking. Yeah.
Have you traveled often to Freetown, and how are you and other Liberians received there?
I was in Sierra Leone in 19. The last time I was there was in 1996.
So a while ago.
We had, yes, a while ago. But I have a lot of friends living there. And, you know, I'm really fascinated by the Sierra Leonean people, the way they talk. They have so many beautiful parables. They have beautiful beaches. It's a very beautiful country. You know, the mountains, the landscape, very beautiful country to be enduring what they're enduring today. I have friends there, so I had to check on some of them this morning to find out if they're safe.
And do you have any news?
No bad news so far, but everyone's still, you know, it's in shock and pain. And some people have lost their relatives and friends as well. So we're still praying that, you know, we're just hoping for the best. You know, what happened there, I mean, Liberia is close by and we are in the middle of the rainy season and it's raining heavily everywhere. And it's a wake-up call for us all, you know, to take some of the preventative measures to ensure that these disasters don't happen again.
Patrice, I want to ask you one more thing. It's not on this topic, but it's something that is right in our face these days. And as someone who travels fairly frequently to the U.S., I mean, Liberia and Sierra Leone, they're the home for many, many slaves who were taken from Africa and sold into bondage in the New World. How have you been feeling lately with all the news from the U.S., these overt displays of racism, not to mention the embrace of white nationalists who want to return, it seems, some of them, to the days of slavery?
That's another shocking thing, you know, seeing the U.S. that we've, you know, held in such high esteem over the years, you know, seeing the U.S. go, you know, I don't know. I just can't. It's just shocking. You know, we are in a constant state of paranoia, you know, because, as you know, Liberians have such close ties to the U.S. and the U.S. has been a place of refuge and a safe haven for all of us, you know, around the world, especially those of our countries, you know, that have a big population there. We have a big Liberian population in the diaspora, particularly in the United States. So seeing everything that's going on there in America, you know, was once an example for us all when it comes to democracy. We are struggling with that because we've long, you know, looked up to the U.S. and seeing all of these things that are happening. It's just a sad time for the world. It's just really sad. And it's a wake up call for all of us to not depend upon the West so much, but to strengthen our own countries and our systems and build what we want for our people instead of always, you know, looking up to the West to dictate how we run our countries. Because it's just a sad time the world over, you know. It's just a sad time.
Patrice Drouin, speaking with us from Monrovia. Thanks for sharing your thoughts today.
Thank you, Marco, for having me once again.
Now a quick preview for a story that's coming up on the show later today. We're going to hear about a documentary that focuses on big game hunting.
You can just pick whatever animal you want from the menu that they offer you, see the price, and book the kill.
Big cats in 21 and 22, sold!
But it's a little more complicated than it sounds.
It does what documentaries do at their best, which is it takes your preconceived notions about a thing, it turns it on its head, it makes you question your assumptions, and informs you about something that you realize you had already made a decision about, but that you knew nothing about.
A documentary that challenges our assumptions, plus more must-see foreign documentary picks from KCRW film critic Matt Holtzman. That's coming up in just a few minutes.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple, jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. 2,500 years ago, the Babylonians had figured out how to predict the next solar eclipse.
They didn't know anything about Newton, but you can say they preceded him by thousands of years.
What eclipses have taught us over the centuries about our planet and the universe, that's still ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Lately, it's hard to get through a day without talking about all the things that are dividing our country. But there's at least one thing right now that seems to be uniting us, and that's excitement about next week's total solar eclipse. In case you've been too preoccupied to notice, it's going to cross the entire country next Monday from the Pacific coast to the Atlantic, and millions of people will be on the move to see it. Among them will be countless astronomers and other scientists. That's because when the sun is hidden by the moon, an eclipse also helps reveal some of the deep secrets of nature. Here's The World's Ari Daniel.
It's a dance that's been playing itself out for millennia. On average, once every year and a half, the moon slips directly between the Earth and the sun, punching a hole of darkness into the daytime sky. And whenever possible, there have been people below looking up. By all accounts, experiencing a total solar eclipse is revelatory. A quick YouTube search will confirm that. They're especially revelatory for people who study them.
I mean, every eclipse gives you new information.
This is Shadia Habal, an astronomer at the University of Hawaii, originally from Syria. And she does mean every eclipse. For instance, 2,500 years ago,
the Babylonians could actually predict the occurrence of eclipses.
They did it using careful records of previous eclipses.
They didn't know anything about Newton, but you can say they preceded him by thousands of years.
Essentially, the Babylonians used eclipses to infer basic laws of motion. Newton, of course, was the guy who later derived those basic laws in the 17th century, building on the work of Johannes Kepler. He'd figured out a set of basic laws of planetary motion a few decades earlier. Habal says neither Newton nor Kepler got help from solar eclipses, but that eclipses soon allowed other scientists to prove them both right. So 400 years or so ago, eclipses confirmed new theories of how objects move, on Earth, in our solar system, and beyond. And those breakthroughs, in turn, help form the foundation of modern science and technology. Fast forward to 1868 and an eclipse in India. A French astronomer named Pierre Janssen,
oh, bonjour,
trained an instrument on the corona, the sun's atmosphere that's still visible during an eclipse as a bright crown encircling the moon, and he analyzed its light to figure out what the sun was made of.
Hydrogen!
Superhot hydrogen gas was easy. That was an element scientists had identified here on Earth about 100 years before. It's the H in H2O. But there was something else. Something that an English astronomer, Norman Lockyer,
jolly good,
later determined was a new element, which he called
helium,
after Helios, the Greek god of the sun. It was unknown to science at the time.
It took about 25 years before it was found on Earth.
Today, helium's used for everything from high-tech magnets to birthday party balloons. And we know about it thanks to a solar eclipse. A year later, during the eclipse of 1869 in Iowa, an American and a Scotsman separately detected what they thought was another new element glimmering in the corona. They called it coronium. It later turned out there was no such thing. Coronium was actually the element iron, stripped of 13 electrons. But that discovery was a big deal, too.
To lose 13 electrons meant the temperature had to be at several million degrees.
Shadia Habal says the discovery showed that the sun's atmosphere is hundreds of times hotter than its surface.
Personally, I think that was a landmark discovery.
It was totally unexpected, and it helped us learn more about how stars work. Then there's the eclipse that helped prove how the whole universe works. It was in 1919, and it was observed by a team headed by British astronomer Arthur Eddington.
Let me just show you.
This is Eddington, actually an actor playing Eddington in the movie Einstein and Eddington. He was seeking to prove a radical new idea, Einstein's theory of general relativity.
Space. The tablecloth is space.
Central to the theory is the notion that space and time form a kind of fabric, like Eddington's tablecloth, and that massive objects, like stars, bend that fabric.
The sun. What's happening?
Eddington tosses a round loaf of bread into the middle of his stretched-out tablecloth.
What's happening with the sun in space?
The sun makes a shape around it in space.
Yes. Now,
Eddington then rolls an apple onto the tablecloth, and it moves around the bread, as though in orbit.
It wants to travel in a straight line, but it can't.
The apple follows the curves made in space.
Yes, and that is how gravity works. Space tells objects how to move. Objects tell space what shape to be. And there's a way to prove it.
Einstein predicted that the gravity of massive objects like the sun would even bend starlight. But of course, the sun is way too bright to measure any starlight nearby, which is where that eclipse of 1919 came in. Eddington sailed to the island of Principe in the Atlantic. Other members of his team went to Brazil. When the moon blocked the sun, they took pictures, which they used to try to determine whether starlight passing near the sun had been shifted by the tiny amount Einstein had predicted. The result, Eddington claimed, was clear. Einstein was right.
In this man's work, in the beautiful complexity of the new universe he has shown us, I, for one, have no doubt.
It's rather dubious because the equipment they had wasn't sensitive enough.
Shadia Habal says Eddington's results actually weren't so definitive.
I think many people agree that it was more hype than reality.
But before long, technology caught up to the challenge, and it confirmed Eddington's conclusion from the eclipse of 1919. Einstein's theory of general relativity was correct. Some fundamental secrets of the universe were revealed. And that's the way it is with solar eclipses. The darkness illuminates our understanding of our sun, our solar system, our universe, of the power of science itself. So the question for this year's eclipse is, what will we learn this time? For The World, I'm Ari Daniel.
Ari will be part of our team covering the eclipse next Monday. He'll be on the ground in Idaho for us and our sister program, NOVA. Before then, though, we want to know what your eclipse plans are. Are you on the road already? Or are you fortunate enough to live under that path of totality and maybe prepping for a horde of visitors? We want to hear your plans, so tweet them or post a photo on Instagram and tag us at PRI The World. You can also leave us an old-fashioned voicemail. The number is 1-877-406-6303. Again, that's 877-406-6303. Talk about fortunate. I've seen two total solar eclipses. July 11th, 1991, in Baja, California was the first. Totality lasted over 6 minutes. Then again on March 29th, 2006, in the desert of Libya. Libya, under Gaddafi then, had just renounced its WMD program and was slowly inching back into the Community of Nations. But it wasn't completely there. Journalist visas were still hard to come by. So I joined a tour, and it was quite a tour. 2 days after landing at Tripoli, we all hopped a 90-minute flight on an early model 707 into the desert, and then a 90-minute bus ride deeper into the Sahara, until we arrived at what looked like a refugee camp. There were neat lines of hundreds of tents, only some of them had big telescopes peeking out. The encampment had been prepared for 2 nights for several thousand professional and amateur astronomers from around the globe, as well as plain old umbrophiles like me. I spent all the next morning trying to get my satellite phone to work, which I finally did, in time to do what seemed like, by then, an anticlimactic play-by-play of the moon obscuring the sun. When we all woke up the next day, we realized the outhouses were beginning to overflow and food was running out, and it was clear that we all needed to get back to civilization in a hurry. Still, no matter where you are in the world, no matter where the nearest toilet is, a total solar eclipse remains one of the most amazing things you will ever see. Okay, have you heard the one about the French Muslim woman who walks into a comedy club? Well, you're about to. Here's reporter Adeline Sia in Paris.
Samia Orozman walks on stage to the sound of classic movies references. Veiled in black from head to toe, she paces the stage in the dark ominously, and then...
Je suis ta mère.
I'm your mother, she says. Oh, that's what scares you? She says, pointing to the black veil. Oh, don't worry. It's a convertible. She pulls off the veil, revealing her turban-covered head. Right then, Orozman takes on the hijab taboo. France bans all religious signs, including the hijab, in public schools and for government workers. Orozman wears a colorful turban instead of a scarf. Something, she says, many people take issue with.
Des gens qui ont dit, mais qu'est-ce que tu fais sur scène alors que t'as un foulard?
Some people ask, what are you doing on stage with a scarf on your head? You should be discreet and not show yourself. I feel like telling them, mind your own beeswax. Some people say, my turban is not as good as a real scarf because my earlobes still show and it's too sexy. I want to tell them the same thing. Some comedians told me I don't belong in the theater with a turban, but it's part of who I am. It's as if I told you I don't like your haircut.
On the day I meet her, Orozman wears a salmon pink turban and matching jacket, red lipstick, and pink eyeshadow. Add to that a bright smile, and you're faced with a fired-up persona. Wearing exactly what she pleases, she says, turban, makeup and all, is Orozman's very own feminist stance. On stage, she explains that her outfit is made of West African fabric because she's always dreamed of being black. Sub-Saharan African women, she says, have class and aplomb. And they're always right. In her show, Samia Orozman makes fun of many more accents and stereotypes. There's the bellicose Algerian. The sing-songy Tunisian.
Allô? Oui? Wallahi, vraiment?
The even more sing-songy but formal Cameroonian. And the little Parisian girl, French equivalent of a valley girl.
Ah la la, j'hallucine. Ah non, mais attends.
It's biting satire, but it never mocks people harshly. Orozmán sees her brand of comedy as equal opportunity offender, and the audience certainly gets that.
It's hard to peg me. In fact, even people who are part of my background don't even understand what's going on. Since I pick on everyone, no one knows who I am. I'm like a UFO. I'm a girl born in France, out of Tunisian parents, dressed like a sub-Saharan woman who lives her life and wears a turban. I don't try to fit any mold.
Orozmán also pokes fun at her Tunisian culture. At the heart of the show is her years-long battle with her mother about dating a black man, a French guy from Martinique who converted to Islam. On stage, Orozmán reenacts her mother's reaction when she told her she wanted to marry him. Mom freaks out and says her daughter is doing that just to spite her.
My mother used to tell me, I'd prefer an Arab who's a drunk to a black man who prays. In fact, it's a visceral racism which is prevalent in the North African community as elsewhere. Everyone is afraid of the other. Tackling this on stage is a way to make people think about it.
Orozmán's mother eventually gave her blessing to her marriage. On stage, Orozmán brags about being an unconventional wife to her beloved husband. At home, he does the cleaning, the shopping, the cooking, and I make a mess. And then she adds, it's so good not to be hitched with an Arab. And to all the Arab mothers in the audience who are going to be waiting for me outside, please note, I'll stop saying this when you start teaching your sons to clean up. In her show, Orozmán aims to make people laugh, but she also wants to open minds.
Je suis constamment dans l'ouverture, dans le partage, dans la générosité, dans l'échange.
I try to be as useful as possible. If I can create bridges where there are walls, I'm very happy. If it works, great. If not, I'll turn to other people.
Samia Orozmán's show Femme de Couleur reopens in Paris next month. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
One more quick item before we head to the break. And it starts with what is these days a universal truth. We all want a better internet connection. So to deliver that, some companies are planning to launch huge clusters of satellites to improve global coverage. Side effect? That'll put thousands of extra objects into Earth orbit. And there's concern this will lead to more dangerous debris floating around up there. Already, the International Space Station has had some close calls with orbiting space junk. Here's my BBC colleague Jane O'Brien on what can be done.
The US Space Surveillance Network can track objects bigger than 10 centimetres, but most debris is much smaller and will remain in Earth's orbit for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Laurie Newman monitors the risk to NASA's satellites and decides whether they need to alter course to avoid a collision.
Unfortunately, we can't track a lot of those small objects right now, so we can only mitigate close approaches with the objects that can actually be tracked, and we rely on the Air Force to provide us with that data. The things that are smaller than a centimeter, the satellites can protect themselves by putting on extra shielding, but the things between 1 centimeter and 10 centimeters, if you can't track it, then there's kind of nothing you can do.
No single agency or nation is responsible for space, although 85 countries are members of a UN committee on peaceful uses of outer space. But there's no accountability for causing space debris and no rules for cleaning it up.
The BBC's Jane O'Brien reporting there. The summer movie season is rapidly drawing to a close. You've got 2 weeks, maybe three, if your summer runs through Labor Day. But if you've still got a few open nights on your schedule, and this is going to sound so public radio, you might want to squeeze in a couple of the new foreign documentaries that Matt Holtzman is recommending. He's the guy behind The Document, a podcast from KCRW about seeing the world through documentary films. So the first documentary I want to ask you about, Matt, is called Barbecue. It's about eating barbecue in 12 countries. What stood out for you with this documentary?
Well, you know, anybody who loves barbecue knows that it has a kind of a tribal aspect. It's people standing around a flame, roasting meat, and there's something very kind of caveman-like about that. And this is a film that really kind of goes to that aspect and how in every place in the world, people do this. They may do it differently. They all claim superiority in it, right? But there is something that is incredibly universal about it. And this is not like a Food Channel movie. It's very meditative, and it very much is about the kind of tribal, nationalistic, but then universal aspect of barbecue. There's a lot of shots of flames and a lot of shots of people standing around flames and a lot of people drinking beer and looking very happy.
And we see Mongolians starting their fire with gasoline, which I was a little kind of dubious about. But there's another documentary that sounds really great. It's certainly darker than barbecue. It's called Machines. Tell us about that.
This is a filmmaker named Rahul Jain, who actually comes from a family of textile makers. And 20 years after he was a kid wandering in his grandfather's defunct textile factory, he's gone back to a textile factory somewhere in India. And it is essentially a tour through this factory. And the title refers both to these wheezing, hulking, greasy machines which are churning out the fabric that becomes our shirts and our drapes, but also the humans that work these machines who become, in a way, a part of them. I mean, they really are kind of another cog in this machine. And it has a certain beauty to it in a kind of repetitive motion kind of way, but it also is terrible because you are seeing the conditions that these people work in, the way they are dehumanized, and what it takes for us to get an $8.99 t-shirt, right? Mm. I mean, it has very little dialogue, very little interview in it, and yet it's so mesmerizing and compelling and ultimately terrible.
So let's stay on this social justice tip for a little bit. Here's a snippet from another documentary called Trophy. This is about big game hunting.
I've been a hunter my whole life. I lost my dad a few years ago, and he was a hunter. And I think that he would be really tickled to be able to tell the people back home at the coffee shop that his son is out hunting a lion.
Tell us about Trophy.
I want to just correct you. You said it's a social movie, and that, to me, sets up a red flag about feeling bad about ourselves and, you know, one more social ill that we have to deal with. And, in fact,
this is not that.
A movie that – well, it does what documentaries do at their best, which is it takes your preconceived notions about a thing, it turns it on its head, it makes you question your assumptions, and informs you about something that you realize you had already made a decision about but that you knew nothing about. And so Shaul Schwartz and Christina Clouseau have gone to Africa, they've gone to parts of the United States, and they've looked deep at the business of trophy hunting, because it is a business and it's a huge business. But it's so tied into the survival of some of these species that you start to understand that it isn't as easy as posting a picture on Facebook of somebody with a dead animal and saying they're a bad person.
People are confused how hunting and conservation go together.
You can just pick whatever animal you want from the menu that they offer you, see the price, and book the kill.
Big cats in 21 and 22, sold!
And that money will all go back into conservation.
The other part of it that's really fascinating is that it really gets to a bigger issue of about the way we judge people, the way we see people, the way we condemn people, and stop conversations from happening that need to happen in order to solve really big social problems.
Let's end on something a little meta, shall we say. There's a documentary you wanted to tell us about called Spettacolo, which is Italian for spectacle. It's kind of about people making a documentary, right?
Well, in a way, yeah. So Jeff Malmberg and Chris Shellen, who are two great filmmakers who created a documentary, one of my favorites, called Marwin Call, they embedded themselves in a tiny Tuscan hill town. It's called Monticello. It's one of those places that you and I might go, you know, during the summer to get away. It's very picturesque and beautiful. And in this little town, all the townspeople for years, for decades, have been creating a play every summer for the tourists about what it is that they're experiencing, what they've experienced during the year.
People came from all over the world to watch us. Every night, we acted out our lives in the center of town.
It sounds kind of hokey, right? Like Little Town does hokey play. But
our town
in
Italian.
Yeah. And like our town, it is quite sophisticated because the people in the town are sophisticated. Mm. And the guy who is the central kind of creative maker of the play is a genius. And so it's a beautiful, meditative film, But it also speaks to the problems that we are experiencing globally in this world, because this little town is a bit of a canary in a coal mine. They're dealing with the financial crisis, and you see that in the play. They're dealing with a way of life that is being threatened because of the changing economy and the changing nature of the world, and you see that in the play. And so it's one of those movies that is very beautiful and really speaks to your heart and makes you think about the state of the world and whether we're headed in the direction that we want to be headed.
Matt Holtzman hosts The Document, a podcast mashup of documentaries and radio from KCRW in Santa Monica, California. There's a music documentary I've never seen. It's from 2011, and it's called Calypso Rose, The Lioness of the Jungle. Calypso Rose is from Trinidad and Tobago, and the film tells the story of her very rich life. But really, every album that Calypso Rose puts out is a document in and of itself. She lives in Jamaica these days, the one in Queens in New York City, but she's still recording. This classic Calypso is from her most recent CD. The tune is Man Smart, Woman Smarter.
Ever since the world began, woman was always fooling man. Listen to me attentively. I want to tell you how the woman is smarter than the man. Not me.
Calypso Rose didn't write Man Smart, Woman Smarter, but she could have. She wrote her first song at the age of 15, allegedly after seeing a man steal a show away from two women on stage in a carnival tent. Music historians say it was the first calypso written about gender equality. We leave you today with Calypso Rose's cover of a tune that we could all benefit from. You'll know what I mean in a second when she gets to the hook. It's her take on the old Burt Bacharach and Hal David song. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup,
I say a little prayer for you.
While combing my hair now, and wondering what dress I'm going to wear now.
Wear now, I say a little prayer for you. Forever and ever, stay in my heart.
PRI, Public Radio International.